friends. Thank you for tuning in. It's great to have you back. I'm Henrik. This is Red Ice TV. We have a video version of the show available, but of course, you're very much welcome to join us in the radio archive as well if you're subscribing to our RSS feed or something like that. So today, our guest is James Alsop. He's first time on the show. I've checked out some of his videos. He does some great work. He has a YouTube channel doing a lot of good stuff in terms of, both what's going on the college campuses, but also just covering what's happened with all the attacks on Trump supporters. And he did tell me earlier, I remember seeing the video a while ago, he himself was actually attacked by Antifa. Where was that, James, again? What event was that?
That was outside Deplorable at Washington, D.C.
That's right.
And there were actually two separate attacks. First, I got punched in the face when some Antifa kid tried to steal my Trump hat, wrestled him down, got it back. And then 15 minutes later, we were leaving the event. And I got hit with a flagpole. So I have had firsthand experience with Antifa violence.
Yeah, they're an honorable bunch, no doubt.
Definitely.
Anyway, so that's good. So welcome to the show. It's great having you here. Why don't we talk a bit about your, your trajectory first. When did you get into this? Obviously, you have a YouTube channel, as I said. Let's throw that up here on screen. When did you start making videos about all this kind of stuff?
So I first started, I never really intended to become someone who was a YouTuber, so to speak, or someone who did YouTube videos. I uploaded a couple videos back in November, I believe, to my channel of me and some friends and people who I work with politically out at a rally on my campus where we were recruiting people for our college Republicans group on campus, and we got protests. We didn't know this would happen. We got protested by Black Lives Matter, by all of the other assortium of campus groups who protest right-wing people at college. And so I just took a video of it. We got some footage there, and I didn't really think anything of it. I just uploaded it to YouTube so I could share it with people in other Facebook groups and on, image boards and stuff. And then a couple of days later, I checked in, and, it had, 5,000 views and then 10,000. And so with that came some subscribers, and I thought, okay, this is kind of cool. I like doing this. So in December, I did my first commentary video, so to speak, where I responded to that MTV Message for White Guys video they put out that everyone made a response to. And that went over fairly well. And so I figured, I don't know what I'm doing that's right. I don't know what is appealing about this to people, but people like it. People are resonating with the message that I am putting out. So I figured I might as well keep doing it. And now 7 months later, here we are, and I have about 115,000 subscribers now, and I'm really excited about that and really excited about the future, where that's going to go.
That's awesome. So where did you come from? It's like just a kind of a general, like a Trump supporter when he was on the rise, you just started supporting him. What was it like for you before that? Did you come from a liberal background or what?
So I came from, I feel like this is something that I've heard this story told to me so many times, but I started out as a libertarian. I first got involved in politics, like so many people, in 2012 with Ron Paul. Ron Paul was what motivated, I think, millions of people to really care about politics. I was 16 or 17 at the time, so I couldn't vote, but I still resonated with those ideas. But as I got a little bit older and as I saw some of the stuff going on in Europe, especially with the migrant crisis, that was one of the biggest red pill, so to speak, for me, was seeing what's happening in Europe. I kind of moved towards more of a Murray Rothbard or Hans Hermann Hoppe type of libertarianism, where I was more right wing, and which put me at odds with many other libertarians. So I have I've never been like the conventional Republican establishment type or the traditional GOP ally. That's really never been for me. I've always been kind of on the outskirts of the Republican Party, in an ideological sense. But that's kind of how I got to where I am today. So yes, of course, I supported Trump in the primary. I supported Trump in the general election, obviously. But since then, I've kind of continued to kind of try to find what I identify with politically, because I feel like the label conservative doesn't really mean anything anymore, and that really doesn't explain what I think about politics, what almost every young right-wing person feels about politics. We're not, George Will traditional conservatives. So I'm still trying to kind of find the correct pronouns, find my identity, so to speak, politically. But That's how I got to where I am today.
Yeah, it's true. I agree with that. It's definitely something, you know, new that's forming to a certain extent. It doesn't fit the mold of the old stuff. And at the same time, it doesn't fit the accusations of the left of what they say that we are either. You know, so it's I guess the truth is somewhere in between, I guess, for lack of a better term. But sure. So tell us a bit about your experiences at the college campuses and what has been happening there, because I would assume that just that experience alone would push a lot of people, if you will, to our perspective, at least if they're white, at least if they're the group that are the most suppressed, if they're the group that can't form a student union, etc. I know that you were following one story on out of Seattle, one of the colleges there. Was it Evergreen, right?
Yes, Evergreen State College.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so essentially what's going on at Olympia is there was a student movement and backed up by the faculty to have a day of absence, they called it, where all white students and faculty would be banned from campus. Traditionally, this day of absence type protest has been where the minority or non-white students, you know, blacks, Hispanics, I guess Jews, Asians, so to speak, all of the other minority groups would not come to campus and would not go to class. But this year they tried to, you know, flip that on its head and change it a little bit. And they tried to make it so whites, students, faculty, et cetera, couldn't go to campus that day. And there's a professor, his name is, I believe, Eric Weinstein. I don't know if he's Jewish or white. I don't know what his background is. But
sounds like it.
He sent out an email saying, hey, you know what, I don't think this is the best way to go about this. I don't think reinstituting segregation is the best way to, you know, accomplish whatever the goal of this protest is. It's kind of nebulous. Oftentimes it's just to bash white people, but which I guess it would succeed at that. But so he sent out an email saying he didn't really agree with the spirit of this protest. And of course, because he dared to challenge the narrative and challenge this, you know, the cultural Marxist iron grip on the college campus, he was immediately labeled as a racist, immediately labeled as a you know, racist, fascist, every other pejorative they use when they're, you know, trying to slander someone. And he has actually not been allowed to come back on campus by the Olympia police because they say it's too dangerous for him to be on campus. So the campus has descended into essentially a what looks to be, in many cases, like a race riot, where there are groups of black students holding white professors and faculty hostage inside classrooms. There are groups of black students surrounding and shouting at you know, old white women who just happen to be teachers at this college. It's really stuff that looks third world. Like I had a hard time believing it when I was watching it, but and yet there it is. And of course, we're not seeing anyone in the as you see here, this fine gentleman here with the braided undercut. That's a new look.
Oh, man.
You're seeing nobody in the media talk about this. And again, I know this is old and it's boring to make this comparison, but can you imagine for a second if there were a group of the white student union, for example, holding black faculty in a class or not letting them out? It would be it would be the flashpoint for a race riot, but the media isn't talking about this at all, and that's why it's only being talked about on places like Campus Reform and independent media.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, the question is how far this is going to go. I mean, before something really tangible is made to try to stop this, as you said, there are a couple of lone voices here and there. You have a couple of professors, you know, yeah, like Jordan Peterson out of Canada, you know, some of the examples you mentioned that are occasionally speaking up a little bit, but not really on a mass scale are they pointing to the double standard. And that's why, as you said, that's really one of the more powerful weapons that we have. We have to fight back on that. What if the you know, the tables were turned in this situation? There would be a national news coverage in America. It would probably spread to the rest of the world, you know? And so what will it take, do you think, for this to begin to get some notice and recognition?
I think it's going to have to isn't that the essence of all of this? That's the big question, is what will it take for people to realize that there are largely two sets of rules in America? I mean, realistically, like, there are two sets of rules. There's one set of rules for the white students. If they were doing this, they would be absolutely arrested or absolutely expelled. But then there's the other set of rules for the students who are, you know, non-white and choosing to do this. And that's not a racist observation. That's not a, you know, bigoted or hateful observation. That's just the truth. That's just the truth of what's going on, not only at Evergreen, but at colleges across the country. there are these what they call bias response teams set up at many schools to go out and to monitor student speech, to monitor professors' speech, and report and then presumably take action against speech they find to be offensive. Well, you know they're not taking action against the Black Lives Matter advocates. They're not taking action against Antifa. They're going to be taking action against someone who says, hey, you know, let's talk about the bell curve. Or, hey, you know, maybe any kind of controversial idea is going to make you the target of harassment, not only by your peers, but also by these institutions that are backed up by big money, backed up by the colleges themselves will be coming after you. So I don't know what it's going to take.
Exactly. Yeah. But I don't know either. I was just like, when are people going to be fed up? When is enough going to be enough? And I'm seriously frightened that it will get to a point where the silence just continues, right? And you have abuses that goes from maybe mental and psychological as they are now into violent ones. And that has started to happen a little bit here and there, right?
Oh, yeah. No, it absolutely has. And I think that's a definitely valid concern. And this is why I'm so frustrated with many people who are on the right wing, or they say they are, a lot of these moderate Republicans or these very basic tier conservatives, because they refuse to have these conversations. They refuse to talk about these things. They, for years, the left has been saying, you know, let's have an honest conversation about race, for example. They say, let's have an honest conversation about race. Okay, we can do that. And people like Stefan Molyneux have been doing a great job at that, presenting, you know, fact-based analysis and conversation about, you know, racial differences. And I think that's great. But, you know, conservatives, to a large extent, don't want to talk about that. They don't, they think that's too controversial. And really, it's not controversial or edgy in my estimation. And I think in most people's minds, it's not that controversial or edgy to say, hey, look, there are differences in, you know, racial groups, and different racial groups are advocating for their interests. And I think that's great. I think it's great that there are, you know, African Americans banding together to advocate for African American interests. That's fantastic. Or Hispanic Americans pushing for Hispanic interests. That's fantastic. I don't have a problem with that. But conservatives, by and large, fail to recognize that identity politics is, for lack of a better term, the law of the land. And you're playing the game whether you like it or not, and you don't get to choose, you know, which jersey you're wearing.
Right, exactly. That's true. Yeah. And I've argued that too many times, that the position that the conservatives hold, to generalize, it's one of individualism. Just as long as we have free markets, it's all good. Doesn't matter what, you know, skin color you are. And anything else, really, that is in the perspective of taking one's own side is race baiting, and that's therefore morally wrong, right? But if you are in a position where you have groups that are working against you collectively, you as an individual will just not stand a chance, right? I mean, it's just the reality and the fact of it, that you will be pushed out of, you know, you will lose your power, you will lose your influence, and you won't be able to stand up to these groups. So I say that, you know, we've been, specifically in the West, we've been scared shitless, for the lack of a better term, into taking not only our own side, but taking a more collectivist side, right? Because that's traditionally associated with the left. And that's why I think even people like you and us, sometimes I hear that the conservatives and right-wingers, they call us leftists just because of the fact that we say, you know what, we got to just start taking our own side and work together with our group at this point, because if we don't, we're going to lose not only the power that we have, the little power that we have, the influence that we have, and we are eventually going to become minorities in our own countries, right? I mean, what else can we do?
Yeah, and I think the unfortunate thing about this is that none of this would be an issue. I mean, if you look at throughout history, I mean, of course, people always will usually align throughout history along racial lines. But in the past, in America, if you look at, you know, even the 50s and the 60s and 70s, to a large extent, race relations were in some degree better than they are now. And so we had, I think, an opportunity to go down a very different path in America. Yet we didn't, unfortunately. And, you know, the rest of the West is seeing this too, to an even greater extent. I think that, when you have countries like Sweden, which I'm sure you are familiar with, or Germany or Austria, that accept in people who don't, you know, they have a different race, sure, but they don't have the same language, the same culture. They don't have anything in common, nothing in common with the native Austrians, Germans, Swedes, that's when you're seeing huge problems because it's almost from different planets. They're not able to a large extent, they're not able to integrate into Western society. They're not able to get jobs, to speak the language, to get along and make friends. So they reside in these enclaves, you know. And last summer I was in Japan. I traveled to Japan and I was, you know, shocked by just how Japanese Japan was. And
isn't it great?
I loved it for that. Yeah. I loved how Japanese Japan, because yeah. the culture, you know, the people, it's amazing and it's great to see that. And I thought to myself, you know, what an asshole I would be if I moved to Japan and said, hey, Japanese man, yeah, you got, you know, thousands of years of history and everything, but you need to change that to accommodate me.
Yeah.
I would feel like an ingrate. You know, that's evil to go into someone's country and demand they change and throw away their history. So I can never see myself doing that, even though I love Japan. And so I think Europe is realizing that maybe unfortunately too late that, you know, other people from across the world may not be so kind. But now I don't think I can blame the individual migrants. I find it hard to blame the individual migrant for making the choice they're doing, for choosing not to integrate, because it's so easy for them to not do that. You know, if you come into a country and you can, you know, subsist and live on welfare and not have to learn the language, not have to integrate into the culture, there's really no rational basis to motivate you to integrate. You
know, exactly.
If the country is not going to force you to integrate, why would you? And so to a large extent, I think the politicians are really to blame for that.
Yeah, it's true. And I've actually they've gone back and forth in this for a while. Of course, the greatest task, we heard that in Sweden for the longest time. But we have to get these people to integrate. If we, you know, it's the biggest crime if we would let them outside of our society and not let them in that way. And there's a lot of economic reasons, there is cultural reasons for why this was very difficult, but I think the solution they went for eventually was to give up on this idea. And you're saying, you know what, us imposing our culture on them, or language even, that's going to be seen as some kind of almost neo-colonialist thing, right? Despite the fact that they're in our countries, right? So they gave up on that, and they said, you know what, let's not do that, because we were wrong about that anyway. But what happens, of course, as you rightly say, is that it creates these very distinct groups within the country, and if the population, if they continue to grow as they do now, I don't see that this is going to end in a particular peaceful way, in a good way, if I put it that way, because it seems that it's human nature. It seems that the humans end up competing for resources and territory, and as to say, usually that occurs along their group interest, their group preference, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely, and history is replete with examples of that happening. And this is one of the interesting arguments that I've had with myself, is in a kind of political theory way, is the value of democracy. Because when you live in a democratic state, and this is, I think, one of the most fascinating parts of Hans Hermann Hoppe's Democracy, The God That Failed, his critique of democracy, he says that democracies and democratic governments will often sacrifice the future, sacrifice their posterity, for the sake of immediate power and immediate reelection. So they'll choose policies that may screw the country in the long run, but win them votes for the next election. So in Sweden, for example, if I don't know what the biggest party is beside the Sweden Democrats, but if the ruling party says, hey, you know, we can get a lot of migrants to vote for us by offering them more free stuff, and they think that's the path to get them reelected, they might not be so motivated to care about what is this going to do to Swedes 100 years from now.
Exactly.
They're caring about the 2018 election. And so that's something that is unique to many democracies, whereas Hoppe argues that monarchies aren't so interested in maintaining short-term power because they have the force of the state to do so. They can make decisions that may be unpopular but will benefit their future and their posterity.
Yeah, and it seems that in terms of a monarchy, of course, what's interesting with that is that usually that's been by DNA or by heredity, but what ended up happening many times in European history is that you had basically rightful people coming in and steering up events in a country, and they were at that point considered to be the king.
Right.
So to a certain extent, it's almost, that's what we need. I think, I mean, you're talking about these, you know, childless leaders in many cases in many of these European countries. Mm-hmm. They don't have anything really invested in the future. It's just temporary. But what's so strange, though, to me, is that you'd think that them denying the majority population in the country and saying, you know what, we're going to just go for this minority group and do everything that's beneficial to them, you'd think that that would take the majority group instantly turning against them. But that has so far not been the case. I think it's maybe that tide is turning right now as we speak. But it seems that, you know, James, that we're almost at that, what do you call it, tipping point, that we might just be, you know, many of us enough to make that change, transformation, and go for like parties like the Sweden Democrats before we basically are outnumbered in our own countries. It's very worrying.
So I've made the argument in the past that all politics, ultimately, this term identity politics is used by people on the left, people on the right. A lot of people on the right say, oh, I hate identity politics. Identity politics is evil. But all politics ultimately is about identity. And it's about advancing your whatever the interests of whatever group you identify strongly with. In the U.S., for example, many evangelical Christians will vote based on who is the best candidate for evangelical Christians. Many, you know, socialists will identify with socialism as their ideology, and they'll vote for the candidate best for socialism or who's more likely to implement socialism. And so people are voting based on identity groups all the time. They just don't realize it. And so when you bring in a strong minority into a country or a lot of people of a minority into a country, country who don't integrate, then they will identify naturally with their racial minority. That's just how history has always worked. And again, there's nothing racist about that. That's just, you know, people, if you look at Hispanics in the U.S., they have a very strong, usually, many of them have very strong beliefs about Hispanic identity. Blacks in America oftentimes believe strongly about black identity. And that's just the way of the world. And so it's no surprise that these people will then gravitate towards political parties or leaders that say, hey, look, I will do what is best for your group. I don't think we can be surprised about that. The thing is, though, in Europe and America, for so long, they've been 95% homogenous, especially in Europe, that it hasn't really mattered so much to them. Everyone is a Swede, right? Everyone's a Swede in Sweden. We don't really have to care about, you know, Swedish identity versus non-Swedish identity. So we can vote based on economic policy or the size of the state or, you know, these economic concerns. But now that the political landscape has changed so much, I think you're right. You know, people are starting to see, okay, I have to pick which group I identify with, and maybe I don't identify with, you know, the capitalists so strongly. Maybe I identify with whatever my racial group is.
Do you think we're at the kind of the tipping point of that becoming more and more acceptable right now to basically take one's own side? Because as you said, we've not been familiar with doing that before, because it was almost like asking a fish, you know, in a water tank to, you know, define the water that it's in or something, right? It's just we've been so inundated with it. It's just been around us everywhere. So all of a sudden, we're challenged almost in a way. I think it's interesting because as you bring this up, it's an interesting kind of philosophical question in a way. But it's like what it almost helps us to redefine also what we consider to be, you know, Swedishness or what's French or what's German, what's Italian, what's American in that sense. Mm-hmm. Because it challenges us for the first time of really like, okay, we have the other in our own territory. And it's almost like, what are we? What is it that we're trying to preserve? What is worth trying to preserve? Because I almost see it as there's a lot of people that are just being sucked up into that globalist, like, you know, corporate culture, and they're fine being there, while there's another side to this that are being, they're pushing in the opposite direction, and they feel, you know what, we're gonna refine what we are. It's gonna be even more clear to us to a certain extent, right? But anyway, back to the initial point. I think we're right at the cusp of that right now, where people are finally saying, you know what, let's take our own side. It's not racist. It's not hateful. It's nothing wrong. And any other people would do that in their own country as well. Japanese would, right?
Well, right. Yeah. I mean, you have this conversation with a Japanese person, and they'll look at you like you're crazy because you're talking about things that are known to them. That's just the way of the world. You know, through Shinto and other Japanese traditions, they have a strong sense of Japanese identity. They know what Japanese is. They know that if you are a gaijin in their country, a white guy, you may be living in Japan, in the state of Japan, but you are not Japanese, right? And so that's the way the Japanese, you know, see this. And I think the conversation definitely is becoming mainstream. It's becoming, to use a leftist term, normalized to have this conversation. And it's something that so many, I think, I think white people are starting to become more aware of race because of the agitation, the anti-white agitation that is going on from the left. And I know personally, when I got to college, I hadn't thought about race at all. You know, I was 18. I didn't really care. It didn't matter to me. But then I started seeing the stuff at my campus where they're talking about how, you know, white men are the oppressor and how, you know, white men are responsible for this and that and everything that's wrong with the world. And to a lot of people, they'll see that and they'll think, you know, damn, I am evil. You know, colonialism happened 500 years ago and I'm responsible for it. And those people are cucks, and, you know, we can possibly reach them eventually. But for me, I saw that, and I thought, hey, wait a second. Like, I didn't do any of this. I'm not responsible for this. I didn't oppress anybody. I've never oppressed a minority. Why are you blaming me for it?
Right.
And so, I mean, eventually, you know, people are going to get sick of getting pushed around and blamed and said, hey, you know, white man, because of your race, you are this, that, and everything else that's wrong. And so that was really eye opening for me to see that, you know, it didn't matter how tolerant or, you know, I guess egalitarian in a sense that I tried to be, you know, you'll never shake the label of being the racist white man or the bad white guy. And so you have to say, okay, like, what am I going to do with that? Am I going to be cowed by that? Am I going to be afraid? Am I going to be afraid of doing anything politically because they'll call you a racist? I chose not to be. I chose to just say, you know, I don't really care if you call me racist or a bigot or anything like that, because I know I'm not, and I know these ideas that I'm talking about are not what you present them to be.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and it's like when you begin to weigh them, like, yeah, being called racist or like losing your culture and country and people forever. I don't know. What do you think? You know,
well, it's even worse. It's, you have to lie. I mean, you have to just tell lies. You have to go out and say that, oh, there is no difference. There are no differences between the
right.
sexes or between
it's
racial groups.
True.
That's
yep.
just fundamentally untrue.
Yep.
And everyone knows that. And so I think it's even worse than you know, just losing the culture. I think it's you're selling out your integrity, and you have to make yourself just this vessel for an ideology that is fundamentally untrue.
Yeah.
I think that, to me anyways, that would be worse. Selling out in that way would be worse than anything.
Yeah, I mean, you have that on your YouTube channel, Following the Truth, wherever it may lead. I mean, we have had that as a motto, if you will, on our channel and website for the longest time as well. And I think that's what it is. It's one of the highest of virtues. I do agree, and I have come to a conclusion that it's not always right. You don't always have to voice all the truth every time when you know it, you know, but at the end of the day, but at the end
sure.
of the day, it should be a path, that we take. That is the high road of letting it go where it does. And you're absolutely right. I mean, at the end of the day, I think that the proposition that our enemies are proposing for us is a far more troublesome path to go. I think it's going to lead to problems. I think it's going to lead to violence. I don't know anyone who's on this side of the fence, if you will, that says, you know what, let's have a lot of violence and let's have, you know, complete mayhem in our countries. No, it's actually the opposite. We want to try to, you know, restore some normalcy. We want to try to restore order and law and balance to this, because as we've talked about now, the trajectory that we are on is it's a volatile path, I think, and I think it's not going to lead to good things. Do you think that is this intentional? I mean, is it so sinister? We're talking about a globalist clique that are there to actually make sure that this is the path that we enter into. Is there anything to that?
Well, I think it's interesting, and you have to look, and this will alienate me from many, many Republicans, but you have to look at what happens when the parties in the U.S., just as an allegory, when power changes, you know, are things really different under the Republicans and the Democrats? No. I mean, you know,
not really.
Trump's in power, we have a Republican Congress, and yet we're still letting in more refugees than ever. We're not getting a wall. We're never going to crack down on illegal immigration. So you look at all these things combined and you think, huh, you know, maybe it's really not so much about who we elect. It's about who is financing them, who is pulling the strings, who the donors are. Because the Democrats, I have a harder time understanding their interest for just regular Democrat politicians. I have a harder time understanding their interest for allowing mass migration. I have a very easy time understanding why Republicans like it, because their donors, which are largely agriculture or big business love being able to pay, you know, underpaid Hispanic labor $2 a day to go work in the farms. And so they're going to finance people who want to keep the borders open all day long. But for the Democrats, I guess some of that's true at the same time, but it's almost harder. So yeah, I think you have to, you know, it's a very uncomfortable realization to come to, that no matter who we elect in the U.S. anyways, things don't seem to change very much. And I think that's true in Europe, to a certain degree. Although, I haven't been following European politics for a long time, only a couple of years, but it seems like when Europe, elects a leader to do something, they will oftentimes get it done. You know, for better or for worse. And Europeans aren't, there aren't as many checks and balances in many of these European systems as there are in America. So it's easier just to get things done from an executive level if you're in a European country. And so, yeah, I think there absolutely is, at least in the U.S., an organized attempt to, whether it's intentional or not, whether the demographic change is the end goal or whether the cheap labor is the end goal, the demographic change is a byproduct, for sure.
That's true. Yeah, that is true. So you made a video about what Trump has been doing so far, or lack thereof, I guess, to be honest. What do you see in terms of that? I mean, was it just a, as usual, just a lot of hot air to get Americans excited about something, and then we can continue business as usual? Or is it just that he's being, you know, on every issue that he's been trying to push, he's basically been fought? They're pushing back. They're changing even his executive orders in certain circumstances. It's impossible to do something, as you say, within the system. Is his intention still sincere, but he's just not getting anywhere because the swamp will just suck everything down into it?
I'm not sure. I don't know if you listened to alt-right radio before it was unfortunately deleted by SoundCloud, but Sticks X and Hammer 666 and Richard Spencer did a podcast where they talked about this pretty explicitly. And Richard was making kind of the black pill case, and Sticks was making the more of the white pill case. I tend to fall more along the pessimist path when it comes to Trump. I think that he is a negotiator, first and foremost. He's always been making deals. And I think a lot of what he promised was intentionally overpromised so that he could work back towards the middle, work back towards the center. And if even subtracting Trump from the equation, even if we pretend this was, you know, right-wing President X in office, all the art of the deal bullshit aside, presidents usually, when they take office, they will satisfy their base first. And then throughout the presidency, they will moderate, and by re-election, they will move to a point where they are more of a centrist candidate. Almost all presidents in U.S. history have done this. So when Trump, within the first 6 months, starts to compromise and says, oh, maybe we don't need a wall, or hey, you know, DACA can stay, this program that allows in millions of illegal aliens, they all have, you know, 3 to 4 kids, we're cool with that because we have to have a big heart. When he starts doing, you know, just cucky stuff like that, that is really sounding the alarm bells for me, because it's unlikely that Trump is going to move further right as a result of it after that. You know, in order to get reelected, Trump will have to, or presumably have to, try to satisfy some of the independents, satisfy some Democrats. And so do you think Democrats will be cool with the idea of ICE vans rolling through the streets with plastic handcuffs rounding up illegals?
Oh, sure.
I would love that, but I don't think the Democrats will.
No.
So I'm kind of pessimistic, but he's doing some good stuff. I mean, I like what
sure.
he did,
yeah.
what he's been doing in the past week or so. I think his foreign policy trip went pretty well. He's been doing a good job keeping us out of war with Syria after that missile strike that freaked me out. But I think we need to be I don't think we need to be Bill Mitchell. We can't be Bill Mitchell's awful. We can't be just a sycophant and promote Trump and whatever he does. But I think that my philosophy anyways, that I want to support Trump and I want Trump to do good things, and I will call Trump out when he does bad things, because I care more about the policy and not about the person.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I went to the, speaking of the foreign policy, someone said, wrong wall, right? When they got to build your own, man, you know? Yeah.
It's a nice wall, now come build ours.
Yeah, that's just it. Oh, well, anyway, you made a video about kind of where the SJW, anti-SJW rhetoric and just attacks on SJWs have been very popular on YouTube, tremendously popular. It's great. It's created a whole subculture, if you will, of an anti-leftist kind of approach, which is awesome. But you made the case in one of your videos that it's basically peaked, right? That's what you said. It's like there has to be something more after this point because we can't just go on and on forever without really having a direction. This has actually been my argument in terms of the left, too, that they come from a perspective of critique only. It's a deconstructive one. It's only complaining and whining and all those kinds of things. Sure, there's a utopian strain maybe within the left, but, you know, that's pretty unattainable. But do you think that we need to offer something which is actually constructive as opposed to just deconstructive?
Well, sure, of course. I mean, I think that the anti-social justice warrior, anti-feminist YouTube, really kind of got its start in 2014 with Gamergate, and that launched this entire, avalanche now that we're seeing of people who are criticizing feminism, who are criticizing just the left as a whole. And I think that's been awesome. I think that has led to a intellectual breeding ground, so to speak, where people are okay questioning mainstream narratives, questioning the ideas they've been taught for years and years and years. And so that is, I'm very fortunate for that. But I think what we're starting to see now is that the anti-social justice warrior just responding and calling out feminism and for being wrong or talking about how Black Lives Matter is crazy and, you know, their zany campus demands, like, that's cool, but it's not really substantive. You don't really have a message when you're just addressing crazy people all day. And so from my perspective, I think that people who are talented at getting their message out there, who are, you know, talented at presenting a product in this kind of space, this anti-social justice warrior space, I think the pathway to success for them is to talk about ideas, to push for their ideas, regardless of what those ideas are. You know, that is something that will keep people in. That is something that is proactive. And I think that's what I'm trying to do with my channel, is to talk about things that are bigger than just, oh, BuzzFeed made a video. Okay, cool. Like, BuzzFeed made a video, but in the grand scheme of things, does that really matter? I think that talking about things that matter is going to be important for people who are in this sphere if they want to survive as content creators. And so taking a more proactive stance, like you mentioned, I think that's absolutely essential. That's absolutely essential. Or, you know, continuing to address these issues that are, again, to use a leftist word, systemic. You know, issues like anti-white bias on college campuses, or anti-white bias in the media. That's something that a lot of people just aren't cognizant of. And so as a result, you know, I have done a lot of work trying to expose that, trying to talk about how, you know, it's wrong to go out there and condemn, you know, all black people for the sins of one black person. At the same time, it's wrong to condemn all white people for the sins of a couple white people thousands of years ago. And so I think that is something where the market is primed, so to speak. Because these kids, a lot of these kids are 13, 14, 15, 16. Like, they're not super informed, not to talk down about them, but they just haven't had that political experience yet to really inform their worldview. And so if they're cool questioning feminism and, you know, cultural Marxism, like, there's an opportunity there for them to step forward and to really move into ideas that are truly dangerous in the word, exactly, in the way that Milo would describe them.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good point, actually, because, I mean, it's also a very safe zone to be in still after all of this. You know, it's like you have the Paul Joseph Watson, and he does some good things occasionally, but it's like, you know, addressing 16-year-old blue-haired feminists, it's like, it's not really edgy. It's not really a challenging issue. And what I was very disappointed with is that he went after, for example, the identitarian movement in Europe in one of his recent videos. It was like, really, man? Our countries are being flooded. We're being demographically displaced. We have a hostile elite within our countries. We're trying to fight back. We're trying to take the identitarian way, because that's a very good way of creating a, you know, just a cultural cohesive attitude of saying, you know what, you belong to a group, come on, come join us to a certain extent, let's cooperate, let's work together, let's try to change this. And by going down that route of saying that that's somehow the problem, you're not speaking for him, but I just wanted to bring it up because I saw it and it annoyed the shit out of me. It's like, really, man, is this the issue? Is this where you go after attacking feminists? You know, it's like,
Yeah, it's this idea that I've heard in my own comment sections before that, like you mentioned earlier, anyone who talks about, you know, race or identity politics is somehow a leftist. You must be on the left. Whereas that couldn't be further from the truth. I'm very, like, frustrated when it comes to Paul Joseph Watson because he's one of those people who really influenced me to get into the whole commentary, I guess, YouTube community. And so I, you know, his content was very formative and very important for me. But he has this habit of punching right. He does it quite a bit. I think the most infamous example of this was when he and Mike Cernovich claimed the alt-right is dead after Hailgate, of course, the infamous Hailgate. And then Cernovich went on to claim that Richard Spencer was like a CIA plant. This whole weird.
I know.
You guys did a video response to this that I remember watching.
Yeah.
And it's just like that kind of stuff is frustrating to me to watch that.
Yeah.
You may disagree with Spencer, obviously. You may disagree with MPI, but that doesn't mean you have to go and accuse them of being, you know, CIA agents or just crazy stuff like that. So I like Paul Joseph Watson's kind of, you know, responses to pop culture, to, feminism. Sure, that's fine. But again, he falls into this trap where he just doesn't talk about things bigger than that. Usually, you know, usually in his content, even the stuff he did about, you know, chemtrails back in the day was like more, I guess, world changing than talking about how much you hate Michael Moore and Miley Cyrus.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's true. It is true. Yeah, it's strange. And, you know, with Cernovich, he, of course, went on to kind of do, it's very interesting. He did kind of the same thing that Richard did with going to the National Press Club and, you know, setting up all these kinds of, I don't speak to the media. And then, like, he's on 60 Minutes, like, a couple of months later. it's
right.
funny. It was just like, man, are you really that just jealous? Was that just what it was about? You know, because Richard did something which he didn't do at the time. But, you know, it's good to have them there, but I agree with you. I think it's just this useless, pointless bickering internally that you would think that people were like, you know what, we have some big disagreements, but we agree on enough of issues to just kind of pull in the same direction instead of just bickering with each other. But at the end of the day, I guess I don't really know what those people want. It seems that they are, maybe they're okay with being replaced in their own country, as long as it's done legally, for example, right? Or it needs to be done in a slow pace, or just as long as we keep Muslims, extremist Muslims out, I'm okay being a minority. I don't know, because, I mean, if that's the stance, then I so completely disagree with them. Huh?
Sure. Sure, and I think that's, I mean, that's a certainly valid criticism. And again, this conversation wouldn't be happening if Paul Joseph Watson would just come out and say, okay, this is what I want. You know, he wraps himself in this kind of this same shroud that Milo did of being a cultural libertarian. What does that mean? You know, that is the most meaningless, I guess, descriptor of yourself that you can have. You know, people criticize when I say, oh, I'm kind of a right wing libertarian. You know, my ideal, I guess, society in a way is one where government is just out of my life. People say that's, you know, meaningless. And you know, we can have debates about libertarianism all day, but they just have nothing in terms of their ideal political structure. This was my big problem with Milo as well, is that Milo would go up there and you know, dress in drag, for example, and talk about how dangerous he is, and then repeat ideas that you would hear in National Review. No, Milo wasn't dangerous. Milo's ideas weren't dangerous. His presentation and, oh, he bullied some Muslim girls. Ha ha, that's fun. But, like, there was nothing really behind, you know, like the Wizard of Oz, you know, there's nobody behind the curtain there with Milo. Like, he just was what he was publicly. And I think that is going to be limiting for people who are in media, for people who are in, you know, any kind of, I guess, right-wing entertainment, you could say. That's going to be so limiting for them because they, if you don't have an idea, if you don't have a message, if your message is just the other side sucks, people can go anywhere and find that. That's not unique. You know, people can just watch the source material and say, yeah, Black Lives Matter is crazy. They suck. And then there's no incentive for them to then go and watch your perspective, your analysis, or your take.
Yeah, that's true. Good point. And, you know, at the same time, of course, we've heard ad infinitum from the media that the Milos, that the Paul Joseph Watson, even the Alex Joneses, they are the alt-right. They are the right. opposition, which has been frustrating for us, of course. But we can talk a bit more about that in the second segment. We're going to get there.
Sure.
There's some other things I want to ask you about. But tell us a bit about your YouTube channel, if there's anything, I guess, new or upcoming that you have. Obviously, the best way to go is to James Alsop on YouTube. Just search for that and subscribe to the channel. Do you have any other like personal websites or anything like that set up?
No, I'm just working on YouTube right now. I'm also on Twitter. I'm at RealJamesAlsop. You can find me there. With the increase in no platforming, you know, with what happened to Richard this past week with his SoundCloud, it's becoming increasingly obvious for me and many others that, you know, there is a need to build our own platforms. So sometime in the future, I'll be doing a website or a blog of some sort. But no, you can find me on YouTube. Just type in my name there. Would really appreciate a subscription. I have a couple cool, really cool projects I'm working on right now. I'm doing a analysis of Tolkien's books, Lord of the Rings series, and how they parallel with like kind of reactionary or right wing politics, which is something that I've seen. I'm sure you've seen these memes where it's like where they relate the orcs to third world migration and stuff. It's pretty funny stuff. So I'm working on that. I'm also doing a video about South Africa and the plight of the white farmers in South Africa, which is going completely underrepresented and not even discussed at all in the media. I mean, you've heard more about this, Baina Alibed kid, this fake 8-year-old account run by CNN or whatever, this Syrian refugee girl, than you've heard about the South African farmers who are being regularly, raped, beaten, murdered in their own homes. It seems like one is of a little bit more significance than the other, but the media is not talking about it, so that burden then falls to us, alternative media. And then finally, I'll be going to Portland this weekend, going to be attending the rally there, the free speech rally, hopefully checking out what's going on in Portland with Antifa and all that, and then possibly tentatively going up to Evergreen State College, the seat of this race battle itself, on Monday to check out what's going on up there. So a lot of cool stuff coming in the works. And if you are interested in that, go ahead and check out the YouTube channel.
Awesome. Yeah, exactly. Here it is, folks. Head on over there. Check out the videos. A lot of good stuff there from James. And of course, what he mentions about the the censorship and everything, that is a big problem, big serious question. I saw some articles in relation to, Richard being censored from SoundCloud, and this is nothing new. This happened many times before, but I saw a couple of other articles, not from The Independent that this source is from, but a couple of others that even openly talked about us, said, Red Ice is still, they're still up there. They can operate. So, I mean, they are very vigilant about going after anyone that proposes ideas that they deem unacceptable. So watch out. So that's why it's important to, support outlets like ours and James, so we can, continue to have our own platforms. I mean, we have our own servers and everything, so that's fine. But the very idea, James, just a quick comment on this before we break here, but the very idea is that we need to be on these other platforms because that's how we reach people. I mean, we can sit on our own corner all day long and bicker and yap and all that, but if we're not allowed to be on Twitter or YouTube or Facebook and all these platforms where millions and millions of people are on, what's the big thing, right? I mean, the idea is to engage in people that think differently and do, expose them to ideas that they haven't heard before. So I think that's very important. Anyway, we'll talk more about that when we return here. So, folks, we're just going to take a quick break here, but then we'll be back with the second hour with James Alsop. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Thanks for watching. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I just finished the second segment together with James Alsop, a good segment. We talked about a lot of different things. Among them, we spoke about equality. We spoke about the left, the issues that they have with the exceptionalism and people, taking off from the norm, as it were. Their issue with, of course, trying to make everyone equal. We also spoke a bit about the Rebel, their choice of hiring Jack Posobiec as their Washington Bureau Chief, I guess that was the title. But also kind of where they're heading in terms of viewership and the fact that they're counter-signaling everything that the alt-right is doing these days, which is, of course, very, very detrimental to them. Jack, as well, has been part of course, making some outrageous claims on his Twitter about sources that he has and everything else. James Alsop actually did a video about that. We'll speak a bit about why that's a very bad idea to go in that direction, and that actually helps to muddy the waters, as it were, for people who are trying to get to real news and steer away from the fake news kind of stuff. So tune into the second segment, the second hour, if you want to hear more. So as you guys know, if you are regular listeners, we are supported by you guys, our listeners, our viewers. This is really the best way for you to support us. This is the only way that we can continue to grow and expand, of course, our TV network that we are building right now. We are expanding the coverage that we do. We're bringing on new segments, more people. We want to get new editors and reporters, researchers, writers, and all that good stuff so we can continue to bring you more material. And we can't do this without you. That's just the reality of it. We don't monetize our videos. You know, we don't get any ads or sponsorships in any other way. So it's only up to you guys to make sure that we can continue to grow. So definitely support us if you like this show. If you do one thing, do get a membership. That's the best way. You can also, of course, donate if you are a member currently and want to continue to provide us with some support and backup. So we thank you very much for that. And thank you so much for listening and watching. Before we continue with James Alsop, just want to alert you to the fact that we have a live show, Weekend Warrior Episode 38, coming up on Saturday, June 3rd. This is at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's 11 p.m. Central European Time. If you can't catch it live, you can, of course, catch it in the archives at redicemembers.com. But it's a lot of fun recording it live, so I definitely hope you can tune in to watch that. It's exclusive for members. We do make some excerpts, of course, for the YouTube channel. But if you want to catch the whole show, that's the place to go. We also have other guests lined up, many shows in the pipeline. Stay tuned for that. Much more coming up. But yeah, in the meantime, we say thank you so much for watching and listening. We'll continue right now with the second hour with James Alsop. So we'll see you on the other side of the break. Stay tuned. Bye.